On Wednesday, July 17th, we heard from a representative connected to a group that helped put recreational marijuana legalization on hold here in Connecticut for the time being. A member of the Bridgeport City Council called in, reacting to an ICE arrest that happened a couple of days ago. And former Republican State Senator Len Susio with more information about the state's controversial early release prison program.
Going to shift gears, Hal, talking about the battle over marijuana. And there is a term now being coined by those who are opposed to legalized recreational marijuana in states here like Connecticut. It flamed out, at least for the time being, no pun intended. Big marijuana. We've heard of big pharma, big tobacco, big tech, big gun manufacturers. Well, there are some people who don't like big marijuana. Joining us right now, one of them, Luke Neferatos, is senior policy advisor and chief of staff for a group called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. He and his group were heartened, at least for the time being, that the marijuana initiative flamed out here in Connecticut. We don't know what the General Assembly is going to do. They may try to rev it up again in the next term. But Luke is here to tell us about his opinion that he wrote not too long ago, published in a bunch of areas. Not to let Congress fall for what he says are tricks and prodding from the marijuana industry. Luke, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Doing very well, Paul. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Tell me about your group, Smart Approaches to Marijuana. What is that and who makes it up?
Of course. Thank you. Yeah, so we are a nonprofit organization, science-based. We actually co-founded by Dr. Kevin Sabet, former senior advisor to the Obama administration, as well as former Congressman Patrick Kennedy of the Kennedy family, who really were concerned about this advent of legalization over the last 6 years with some of these states. Basically, you know, seeing that the public health side of this was not being heard, that there's a lot of misinformation out there, that people don't realize that the marijuana of today is just so much different than the marijuana of yesteryears. I mean, you look at the Woodstock days, the weed there was 3 to 5% potency. Now these pot shops in legal states are selling 99% potent products that are just a totally different ballpark and much more addictive and harmful. So they wanted to get a science-based organization together to put out facts, research, truth out there, not go back to the Reefer Madness days, not try to put our heads in the sand, but to argue for sensible reforms, alternatives to incarceration for people, but maintaining, a strict ban on this a new drug industry.
Because, you saw what was going on here in Connecticut. You saw the battle that we were having, and it's still not settled. But I know from what your folks told me and from reading your pieces that one of these states you're watching very closely is here in Connecticut.
Yes, Connecticut is a great importance to us because obviously it's very important state in just this whole region, and we were very heartened to see the legislature reject legalization again this year. I actually flew in myself and did a lot of work. A lot of other folks did a lot of work on the ground there in Connecticut. There were a number of members of the clergy, social justice activists, others who were very heartened because, at the end of the day, you mentioned the tricks that this industry does. One of the biggest tricks they do is to say that legalization is going to be social justice. That is the biggest myth of them all. And, and I think we realize that in Connecticut because this industry, everywhere it's been allowed, which is just a few states here across the country, Colorado, where I'm from, everywhere it's been allowed, it is preying on minority communities. There's a pot shop for every 42 residents in our poorest communities of Denver, Colorado. They have less than 1% of the ownership of any pot company is any form of minority. So they're following the same playbook as big tobacco where, we all know where the tobacco shops are. We know where the liquor stores are. We know where the payday loan stores are. And these pot shops are following the exact same route. So the social justice thing is a total trick. It's being used to try to trick legislators as well as the public into wanting to legalize. But the reality is, and this is what our organization stands for, there are better ways to reform marijuana laws. We shouldn't rush into full legalization. We should look at ways to decriminalize people who, have small amounts of marijuana, but we shouldn't fully legalize a new, brand new, huge, multi-billion dollar commercial industry, which is what's happening.
And Luke, before we had a break there for traffic and weather, you were talking about the social justice angle of that, and That's been tried already, as you know, here in Connecticut, here in Bridgeport, where I'm speaking to you from, Hartford, New Haven. And one of the leading opponents to that, I don't know whether you met him when you were here, Reverend McCluster in Bridgeport, they are pushing back the black and Hispanic ministers in the state, clergy, leaders, who say, wait a minute, the last thing we need here in our communities is more drugs, more weed. And what the General Assembly tried to do here, and I know you alluded to this, was to say, well, you know, but look at all the look at the money we're going to give you. Look at how we're going to go through, as you said, the social justice avenue to fix everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and that's the other myth, right? For the first myth is social justice. The second big myth is all this quote unquote money that people are going to make off of this. Notwithstanding the fact that, you know, I already established that less than 1% of any form of minority is at all in any kind of business ownership of a pot shop in this country. Not only that, you have major players who have cornered the industry already. Altria, which is the owner of Philip Morris and Marlboro, the biggest big tobacco company on the planet, has put in more than $4 billion into the marijuana industry. You also have the former CEO of Purdue Pharma, who brought us OxyContin. He's in on the marijuana industry. You also have the biggest alcohol brands are in on the marijuana industry. So this is going to be, you know, if this is legalized, it will immediately be consolidated by the already big, rich, white players from Wall Street and Silicon Valley. So, anything that Connecticut's legislature wants to do to try to say, you know what, we're going to try to kind of, you know, portion off some of the licenses and other things to make sure that, you know, members of minority communities get access. I mean, all of that is out the window when a player like Altria is involved. And these big companies know how to get around the rules. Once it's legalized, they put in all their lobbyists. You know, mm-hmm. In Colorado, the second biggest lobbying presence on the Capitol is the marijuana lobby, which is significant. And so you've got literally, I think, more than 100 lobbyists now just for the marijuana industry in Colorado. And so the influence is big. It's very much reminiscent of the big tobacco days 100 years ago, where we even had to just fight and claw just to say that tobacco was harmful and addictive because they didn't even want to acknowledge that. Now with marijuana, we're having the same debate. The science is settled on this. The National Institutes for Health, the Lancet Journal of Psychiatry, the Journal of Addiction Medicine, the American Medical Association, all of the world's foremost medical institutions agree and say that marijuana is an addictive, harmful drug. And they don't support legalization. So it's really one of those things where the science is very much established, but we now have a big industry that has, you know, multiple million dollars of ad budgets that's putting out slogans and saying, you know, marijuana is not that bad. It's very much the same thing as what we saw with big tobacco.
Yeah, you know, and Luke, you know, a lot of my friends, very well-intentioned, we talk about this, I take calls on the show about this all the time, but they say, that's the thing that just drives me crazy. Well, it's the same as alcohol. Now, look. We all know booze. We all know the death toll that alcohol can cause from drunk driving or impaired driving or cirrhosis of the liver and stuff like that. But I try not to expound on these things until I talk to experts and read what I've read and what these experts tell me and obviously tell you is, no, it's not the same as alcohol. It's just not. But that argument drives me crazy.
Yeah, well, it's. I mean, obviously, it's a red herring. I mean, they're talking about a completely different drug, and as if that's a reason to, you know, do anything about marijuana. But, you know, here's the fact: is alcohol is used by more than 60% of the population. The notion of trying to trying to do anything to make that criminal is crazy. But, you know, marijuana, on the other hand, is used by less than 10% of the population. Mm-hmm. And that may surprise a lot of people out there, but that is rock solid data coming from the national surveys on drug use and health. Only less than 10% of Americans are regular marijuana users. Many, probably closer to like 50%, 40% have tried it once in their lives, mm-hmm. never gone back. But we're not talking about a major, issue here. We're talking about a small segment of the population. And from a public health perspective, we've got to ask ourselves, you know, we've already got tobacco, we've already got alcohol, we've got big pharma, we've got opioids. do we really want to have another substance layered on top of that with a big industry behind it? And so that's the question. Is not, you know, is it any better or worse than any other drug? The question is, we know what's happened with other predatory drug industries. Do we really want to add another industry to the table? And I don't think we do. From our organization's perspective, we should learn the lessons of the past and not allow this big tobacco-like industry a foothold in our nation.
Luca Niferatos is the guest, senior policy advisor, chief of staff for Smart Approaches to Marijuana. He and his folks are on the ground here in Connecticut in the recent debate about it, which is not over yet, but it's kind of in neutral because the votes were not there in the General Assembly to get anything passed of substance. Luke, what is your answer and your group's answer to the folks who say, well, listen, we understand your concerns, but at least doing this, Luke, decriminalizing it, legalizing small amounts of recreational weed, at least this will get much, or if not all, of the crime and the criminals out of it, not involved. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, you know, I guess I would say that's big myth number three. That's one of the final tricks that they use is they say, yep, the drug dealers go away, the cartels go away. I guess they hope that they'll become dentists. unfortunately, that is not what happens. So Colorado, after we legalized, we allowed three new big foreign cartels to come into our state, and they set up shop. The black market has never been worse. The illegal drug market has never been bigger. And not only in Colorado, but let's go over to California. Their governor just said that the black market has only gotten worse since legalization of marijuana. And not only that, he just called in the National Guard to help fight against the black market grows of illegal marijuana. So, you know, there's this kind of fallacy out there that, oh, you know, we can just regulate this and we're going to get rid of the drug dealers. But, you know, maybe that worked with alcohol for various reasons. It's a different kind of drug to produce. But marijuana is way too easy to grow. It's way too easy to distribute. And the cartels are making a heyday on this.
So, and also in these areas, Luke, it kind of to me, I said one of the dangers was, and we were debating this on the show, watch out because of what happened with cigarettes and still happens from time to time, that sure, you grow all this stuff and you sell it legally, but for example, here in Connecticut, they were talking about three levels of taxation, a state tax, a local tax, and then a transference tax for each flower and each amount of stems that's not smokable or whatever. Well, what are people going to try and do? They're going to try and, as you say, go black market and avoid the tax. And like they do, and they did, and they still do from time to time with cigarettes, right? You find guys selling stolen.
The black market will always have a better price.
Yes, the price will always be better.
Yep. And so we're caught in kind of a death spiral with these drugs we've allowed, right? Tobacco and alcohol. And so the question is, okay, you know, you want to talk about bringing in marijuana, and you know, just as you alluded to, simply raising taxes on it is not going to be enough to reduce the use of it. And so if we all agree with the science, which is that this drug is not like the drug of yesteryears, this is a brand new, highly potent drug that's now being put in candies, gummies, and ice creams, that's up to 99% potency. If we agree we don't want more people using that, then we should not legalize it. Because the drugs that we have made, that we've kept illegal, the impact they have on society is dramatically less. Far more people die from our legal drugs, alcohol and tobacco,
sure,
than ever die from our illegal drugs.
So in the few minutes we have left here, Luke, if and I don't know, you probably, obviously, we're here in the state, you probably uttered this, but if you again were to face the leadership of both major parties in the state and Governor Ned Lamont and his staff here, what would be your advice on moving forward with this here in Connecticut? Because it's likely not going to go away. It's probably going to come back again.
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is we need to slow down. Okay, there is a really big rush to legalize, but we have to think about what a rush benefits. The only people benefited by a rush to legalize are the industry and the folks who want to make money. The public, the people whom they serve, are most benefited by a careful, slow-moving, thoughtful approach to any form of drug policy, let alone marijuana policy. So that's what I would say first is let's go slow. Second, we'd say, look, let science lead this. So first of all, you know, we can look at ways to decriminalize small possession of marijuana. So I don't think anybody should be getting a permanent criminal record because, you know, they had a joint in their pocket. So we should look at reforms on that front to ensure that people aren't just being incarcerated unnecessarily. I think that's a key need. And then we should definitely push for more research. There are obviously potential medical benefits to the marijuana plant, but it has many components. It's a very complicated drug. It's one of those things that really needs to go through the FDA. And just the idea of kind of putting this all to a vote, of a popular vote, is really kind of scary. So we should let science guide that process. And then finally, I would say we need to have a full-on public health education campaign on marijuana to remind the public of this is the science. This is the marijuana of today. This is not the joints of Woodstock. This is candies, gummies, shatters, and this is what it has, the effect it has on your brain. You know, it drops your IQ, et cetera. These are the problems that are, you know, this is why the laws are the way they are with this drug. Because right now, the American public just, I don't think they remember. And they've got now they've got an industry that is very well funded, that is putting out a lot of, you know, half-truths or even just blatant false statements out there. And we've got to set the record straight. We've got to let public health lead the way.
And you're right, because the people that are making policy now on this, the members of the General Assembly here in Connecticut, the members of the U.S. House and Senate, two of the guys you say that are being pressured, Richard Shelby and Mitch McConnell, look, if they smoked, and I'm sure they did, you're right, it was nothing like the pot that I even smoked occasionally in school, you know, 30-something years ago. And yet,
it's a whole different animal.
And yet I try, you know, I try, Luke, to explain this to people, and I get, it must be frustrating because you must get the same thing I do. Oh, that's crap. That's bunk. That's Big Pharma. That's the one I hear now, Big Pharma, that's misinformation.
Yeah.
And I'm
they always say, oh, Luke, your organization must be funded by Pharma. So let me set the record straight.
Right.
We haven't accepted a dollar from Pharma. We haven't accepted a dollar from alcohol, not from tobacco, not from any form of industry at all, ever. We've never taken money from those industries. But I will tell you, all four of the industries I just named have put in billions, not millions, billions with a B, into the marijuana industry. So if you have a problem with pharma, I guarantee you will have a problem with the marijuana industry and with legalizing marijuana.
And you know, Nick, hey, Luke, I'm sorry. The other thing is, and the guest is Luca Niferatos from Smart Approaches to Marijuana. This is indisputable, too. And I show this to friends of mine and people I debate on this, and I get crickets back on the other end, that there is a definable, everywhere this has been legalized, there's been a definable and verifiable jump in traffic accidents. And in some states, if you have seen, it's as high as 10% in some states.
It's even higher than that. So in Colorado, this just came out about 6 months ago. So it has, the number of marijuana-impaired driving deaths has increased 152% since legalization in Colorado. Washington State saw them double, almost triple. And then in Oregon, more than half of their drivers, this is according to AAA, more than half of their drivers have tested positive for marijuana.
That's amazing. That's amazing. More than half.
Yes. So it is astonishing the data we're seeing on the roads. And, you know, a lot of people don't even know that it impairs your driving. So Washington State actually did a survey of people that they caught driving high. And 64% of them said they didn't think it impaired.
Well, you know, Luke, that's what I say. People, friends of mine, well, you know, I'm more creative when I'm high, or I can sing better. I said, no, you think you're more creative because, in fact, you're high. Okay, you're still tone deaf and you can't write. So just sit in the corner with a bag of Doritos and leave everybody alone. Luke, thank you. I appreciate it. Name of the group, folks, if you want to check it out, it's called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. The website, learnaboutsam.org. Learnaboutsam.org, nonpartisan site. You heard Luke just say they don't accept money from anyone. They just go by science. Luke Niferatos. Luke, let's stay in touch. Fascinating stuff, and we will talk on down the line. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. You have a great day.
Thank you. There you go, folks. So if you want to check it out, learnaboutsam, is it Mike? Learnaboutsam.org. Smart Approaches to Marijuana. What appears to be the only recent Immigration and Customs Enforcement or ICE detention in the city since what was a major sweep of some cities over the weekend. Gentleman was arrested, picked up, police think, and officials think, on Monday. Joining us right now to talk about that and with some unease on the situation is ID Nieves. Of course, she is the president of the City Council in Bridgeport. ID, Paul Pacelli here. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. What are you folks hearing? I know that there was some consternation. There was some concern as to what happened to this guy, whether he had an active warrant, whether why he was picked up. Any information from ICE on this?
At this time, the chief of police, in the last report that I received, was awaiting to hear from the ICE officials about why he was pulled over. Initially, the gentleman was leaving home to go to work when he was pulled over by an unmarked car and detained. The question here is why was he detained and not detained outside of his home? And they hadn't been at his home, but speculation has that they were looking for someone else, but we're trying to get that confirmed because we were told unofficially that he fit the description of someone that they were looking for, but we haven't gotten an official response from the ICE department as of yet.
Interesting. So, Heidi, so you're saying this could, at this point, this could be a case of mistaken identity?
We're not even sure at this point, but we do know that is what they initially had reported, and then the second version of that was that there was a warrant for him because he had missed a court appointment. So, you know, the chief has received conflicting stories, and we are waiting a detailed report from the chief, both the mayor and myself and the rest of the council, who will express concerns over this matter because we were not informed as a city that this was going to be happening. So knowing, unbeknownst to the law enforcement community here in the city of Bridgeport, it just happened without any advisement, from what I'm hearing.
So, and Heidi, on these kinds of situations, and knowing what the laws are here in Connecticut about, you know, local police, be it Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, wherever around the state, what they can do and what they can't do, is it difficult to get information from ICE, or is there a, whether you know this or not, or whether the chief knows this or not, is there like a, I guess, a defined channel that's easy or not easy to go through on things like this?
Well, as of right now, after speaking with the chief at length about this on Monday evening, there isn't a clear set chain of command that that worked to notify him. I know that they have an ICE office in New Haven, which was not the officers that picked up the gentleman. It was actually the ICE detention officers from Hartford, which came down all that way. So that seems to be the break in communication and process, right? So I know that in the past, when ICE officials from New Haven have contacted the chief previously to let them know that there was someone that they were looking for in another instance, but from at this point, he was not informed at all at that point from any ICE official from Hartford that they were coming into the city of Bridgeport looking for any said individual that they picked up actually on Monday.
Heidi, I know from what I've read and heard other spots, there's some concern, you say, with members of yourself and the council and the mayor's office about the use of unmarked police vehicles or unmarked law enforcement vehicles in a situation like this. Talk a little about that.
Yes, there's a serious concern. Initially, when the chief phoned me in the morning after the incident took place that he was notified by our EOC center, there was already a flurry of pictures on the internet by individuals who were driving down Washington Avenue and saw what was happening. And at first, they initially thought it was the police because it was a red SUV, unmarked SUV, and the jacket, the vest that the individuals were wearing said police. But when they turned over, they realized it said ICE. And when you're in a city or any urban center, that raises a lot of concerns when it comes to public safety in regards to if there is an incident and police have to pull someone over, is an individual going to feel compelled to pull over because they don't feel unsafe or they're unsure if it's really an officer? And that is where the council and the chief and the mayor are extremely concerned and agitated with the fact that this happened. We weren't aware that this was happening, and this sends a bunch of red flags throughout our community, and it's a risk for those that are driving, for those that are being for actual infractions, and also for our police department, and it creates a sense of insecurity, extreme insecurity for our residents who are now even afraid to come out of their houses because they're afraid that they might be pursued at any time. And it makes them feel uneasy, and we as council feel uneasy as well.
How do you handle, what do you then feel, ID, is the best way to handle scenarios where you may have somebody in the city who might be, say, a danger to the community, not just because of their immigration status, but something they may have done, but they need to get, they may have an immigration question, possible deportation order. Is there a synergistic way in your mind that the federal agents, whether they come out of Hartford, Bridgeport, or New Haven, and the local police can work together? Because I know Bridgeport is not technically, what was passed here is not technically a full sanctuary city, but is this still kind of a process going on here, a work in progress?
Well, at this time, because I haven't met the mayor and the chief of police and the council, have not had time to really digest a cohesive plan.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's about ensuring that the ICE officials reach out to the police department. Though we are not participating in the event, we are not supporting or working with ICE because we are a welcoming city and we will not divulge information about our residents to ICE officials. We do want to ensure the safety, and if they do have to pick someone up, it's just giving us the ability to have that information. At least if there's an issue in regards to public safety for the community in general, we can kind of be aware of something that's going on in the neighborhood.
Because, mm-hmm.
for example, this is something I explained to the chief yesterday. There was an incident where a car crashed, turned over, and one of the vehicles that responded was an unmarked police vehicle, and it was just a flurry of phone calls to the police department, to elected officials, that ICE was detaining someone when it was a pure accident because of the fear. So these are the things that we are trying to avoid from happening. And that is one of the things that we're going to be meeting about tomorrow, first thing in the morning with the mayor and the chief and myself.
Oh, great. Excellent. So listen, we're going to probably get back to you then, maybe a little later in the week if we could, or the beginning of next week. We want to keep on top of this and keep people keep people informed on this.
And if I can just add one last thing before we end here. I just want to reiterate that we are going to do a full-fledged campaign of getting information out there for residents to know their rights. And we want to ensure those in our community, if you have a public safety issue, if you have an incident that happens and you need assistance, do not fear by calling city services, because we will wholeheartedly be there and service any resident in the city of Bridgeport for any need that they have, regardless of their immigration status. And that is something that comes from both the mayor, myself, the chief of police, and the fire department. So if you are in need and you need to call 911, we will not be asking immigration status, and we want our residents to feel safe and secure in our community.
And if ICE does have to pick up somebody, ID, you just want, you want some sort of notification or justification beforehand. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. We just want a notification, because if that way, if something happens and we get alerted, the police department, the public safety officers are alerted, our police department is alerted, they kind of know what is happening within the city, and there's not this fear and confusion right now, because even, I want to say, people were confused when they saw what was happening on Washington Avenue. Mm-hmm. They were thinking it was the police, and then someone realized that it was ICE.
All right. ID Nieves, head of the president of the Bridgeport City Council. ID, thanks for the time. We'll be in touch down the road, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Well, there you go. What do you think? One of the great guests we love having on, buddy of mine, former Meriden State Senator Len Suzio, who is still keeping his eye on things in Hartford regarding spending and a controversial program that may have bitten us in the rear end again. Len, how are you?
Great, Paul. I always love listening to your rants. Let's hear one of your rants. It's time for one.
Now, I got to space them out, Len. You know the old thing, less is more, right?
You're right.
But apparently we're talking about this arrest that was made last weekend. The dad of a girl reported that his daughter received an Uber ride from Stonewall Lane in Fairfield, and now the driver allegedly sexually assaulted her, 31-year-old Dwayne Miller of Bridgeport. And Len, what did you find out about Dwayne Miller?
Well, Dwayne Miller had a criminal history. He'd been in Connecticut prisons for a number of crimes, and he had participated in the notorious early release program, whereby criminals are allowed out of jail sometimes years ahead of schedule for participating in a program that is supposed to reform their behavior, but really is more of an excuse to open the prison gates wide open and reduce the prison population. Money is driving it more than the safety of citizens, unfortunately. And as you and I have discussed, in fact, the last time you and I spoke a few weeks ago, we were talking about the program itself and how there have been 15,000 violent crimes committed by Connecticut inmates, convicts who have been in prison, participated in the program, intended to rehabilitate their behavior, and it failed in at least 15,000 cases since its inception in September of 2011. That's the equivalent of more than six violent crimes being committed every day for the last 7.5 years by criminals who supposedly were rehabilitated. It's not working.
How were you able to relatively quickly, Len? I know you filed a lot of FOI stuff in the past. You have active files that I know you have on spreadsheets. You have your sources. How were you able to figure out that Mr. Miller, the gentleman charged in this case, had a criminal history?
Well, I have the inmate files for all Connecticut prisoners, and it's updated every 6 months because of a Freedom of Information Act agreement I have with the Department of Correction. So it has the detailed information about every single inmate that's been incarcerated and discharged from Connecticut prison since September of 2011. I have the original source. I can actually detail who committed what crimes and, you know, who participated in the early release program, right down to the exact prisoner and when they were discharged and what crimes they've been committed of. So I not only have the statistics, which themselves are just overwhelming and shocking and disturbing, but again, I can tell you each unique inmate's identification and what they did and when they were discharged from prison and what crimes they committed. And that's what got my attention. Literally, Paul, you and I every day could have the crime of the day. We could have a segment on your show, the crime of the day committed by a reformed Connecticut criminal.
Len, how much time, if you were able to determine regarding the suspect here that's facing these charges now out of Fairfield, the sexual assault charges, a guy who was driving an Uber here, Dwayne Miller, how much time did he get to not serve? In other words, how much credit, I guess they called it credit time, was he given? Have you been able to figure that out?
Yes, he was credited with 309 days early release during his prison incarceration. So he was let out almost a year earlier than he should have been. And again, sometimes these discharges, these crimes occur within the period of time in which they should have been in prison. Sometimes they occur afterwards. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that the hocus pocus and the nonsense that the Malloy administration used to throw about, well, he would have been out anyways. In some cases, that's true. But my point is, in every single case where a former Connecticut criminal, a convict who had been participating in a program intended to reform their behavior, then goes back and commits a crime, every single one of those situations indicates the program didn't work. It didn't rehabilitate anybody. And when I mentioned 15,000 violent crimes, I'm not counting the thousands of other crimes that I don't consider violent, like, you know, technical violations of probation or parole or something like that.
Or purse snatching or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm talking about violent crimes, you know, where you're raping, pillaging, you're assaulting people, you're stealing. And again, I have all the details about that. I can tell you exactly how many crimes of what type have been committed. I want to make the public outraged about this because it is an outrage. It's an insult. It's a failure on the part of Connecticut's legislature and its governor to engage in the first business of government, which is to protect us from those who would prey upon us. This is just a failure of a program that has been a betrayal of the most important responsibility of government to our citizens, to protect us from those who would prey upon us and harm our lives and our property.
Now, I know, Len, that you've been going to various outlets here, and I'm glad you're here with us, but you've been on various other outlets saying, hey, by the way, this gentleman, 31-year-old Dwayne Miller, was an early release guy. Have you gotten any blowback on that? Anybody, the way they used to during the Malloy years, you know, email you or call you up and say, listen, Len, give us a break on this. The program does work for a lot of guys. We expect to have some recidivism. Any blowback on this one?
I think they've given up.
Because they know you're not going away.
No, and that's right, because I've been doing this now for 7 years. And again, I have the details to back it up. I'm not just bloviating about, oh, here's a one single incident. If this was an exception to the rule, I might not be so upset and irate about it. But this is a common occurrence. I was kidding before, but I said, you really could have a daily feature. We could talk about the crime of the day committed by a supposedly rehabilitated Connecticut convict who has returned to their life of crime and has assaulted some poor citizen. This is just one example, Paul. Even when I talk about serious crime, by the way, we talk about rapes and murders, sexual assault.
Yeah.
On average, since September of 2011, when they instituted this program, a murder or rape or sexual assault has been committed every 8 days by someone, a convict who had participated in the program and was let loose from Connecticut prisons so early because of that. So I just wish that I had hoped that with the change in governors, because Governor Malloy was clearly 100% behind this program, and Mike Lawler, his henchman, his right-handed henchman who conceived the program, I was hoping that Governor Lamont might be open to reforming the program and saying, look, let's at least add some more violent crimes to the list of the very few. There's only 7 crimes that are not eligible for early release in Connecticut.
Yeah.
But so you can be guilty of sexual assault on a child and still be eligible for early release. And that's a crime that's got a very high degree of recidivism.
You see, that Len, that's from another universe. How can you get an early release and have sexually assaulted a child here in Connecticut? And again, please, we're not saying anything like this happened with Mr. Miller. He's going to get his day in court. We understand that. But, you know, he was released early. He does have a record. How is it that the General Assembly didn't add sexually assaulting a child to this whole thing? Len, do we know whether, would Dwayne Miller still have actually been in jail on this or not? Have we been able to figure that out?
No, he would have. He received sentences of 1 year and 42 months, and so he would have been released, regardless of whether he had gotten the early release credit. So he falls outside that scope. But again, Paul, this is some kind of a distraction that Mike Lawler and Governor Malloy used to use. They used to say, well, in many of these cases, the prisoner would have been out anyway, so what difference does it make? But my point just is this. Why are they defending a program where every single crime committed by one of these discharged inmates is indicative that the program failed in that particular case? And we're not talking about just a few crimes here or there.
Yeah.
We're talking about tens of thousands of crimes being committed. It fails far more often than it succeeds. And every time it fails, a Connecticut citizen, an innocent victim, pays the price. And sometimes the price is their own lives. It's too big a price to pay for the failures that do occur, and there is too many failures that do occur, Paul. Even when there are incidents or times when you might say it potentially does work in some cases, the consequences of failure are too catastrophic and too personal for too many innocent victims.
Is it possible, Len, and you saw this when you were in the General Assembly and you were akin to a lot more of the budgetary issues and things like this, is it absolutely possible? Do we have the prison room and the money that every single prisoner has to serve every single minute of their sentence? Or, as you say, is the better idea to add more different types of crimes that are not eligible for early parole?
Yeah, well, that my idea and the more practical approach is just that, is to identify particularly vicious crimes beyond the 7 right now that are not eligible for early release and to make those additional crimes ineligible. I had actually had a bill that I had proposed that made about 4 more crimes, including assault of of a pregnant woman resulting in the death of her unborn child, assault of an elderly person, a blind or disabled person, and a sexual assault of a child to be ineligible for early release. And I couldn't get it passed through the legislature. There were too many Democrats that they're just adamantly opposed to this. Their only version of criminal justice reform is more lenient criminal sentences, not stricter enforcement. And by the way, there's shocking numbers, Paul. When you look at the plea bargaining regarding most of these cases have been pled down to a lesser crime to begin with. And there was a statistic I saw the other day. I don't know if I can quickly find it because I have all the stuff stored on my computer. Mm-hmm. But there was a statistic I saw the other day that something like 97% of criminal cases in state laws are plea bargained down to a lesser crime just to get things through the criminal justice system that much faster. And you know, that's a betrayal of not only the safety of the citizens, but it's a betrayal of the victims of crime.
Yeah.
Because now a woman's been raped, that's forever. I mean, she's got to live with that forever. When her assailant is let out of jail early and exacerbated by the fact that he's got a reduced sentence to begin with, where's the justice in that? Where's this, you know? Where's the Me Too movement? They ought to be screaming. I thought I would get support.
No, are you kidding? Come on, Len. What are you, nuts? Are you kidding? you know why, Len? Because you had an R next to your name and not a D. If you were a Democrat, they would have thrown rose petals in front of you. Len, thanks, man. I appreciate it. We'll be in touch, all right?
Well, again, I'm waiting for your next rant.
With all right.
Great anticipation. Take care.
Thanks, Len. Man, if he's anticipating that. Well, there you go, folks.